Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPN 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
We are in the interview part of the show. Joining us is a true crime author that's written several books. His latest book is called Tortured with Love, and it's the true crime romance of the Lonely Hearts Killers. Welcome to the show, JT Hunter.
Thanks, Alan. I'm excited to be here. Looking forward to talking to you.
So, JT, this is your new book. What drew you to this story, you know, the Lonely Hearts Killers and that sort of thing? How did you find this particular story?
Well, for this particular story, I kind of just stumbled across it doing, you know, basic internet research. I don't remember exactly how I came across it, but I do know that I kind of just stumbled across it and read a little bit about, you know, basic outline of the facts of what happened, and thought it was really interesting. I mean, it's a little bit of an older case. It didn't happen real recently, but the events that happened and kind of the underlying theme of what happened, I think really still resonates today. I think the story really still has a lot of meaning today, even though it, you know, the events happened a long time ago. Because it, you know, it has this underlying theme of love and you know, kind of passion and like what are people willing to do for those kind of things. So that's really one of the big things that attracted me to the story.
Let's talk about some of the basic points. When did this happen, and who are the key players?
Okay, so the two main players would be Martha Beck and Raymond Fernandez. And just kind of in broad strokes, what had happened is how these two came together. There were back in this time period, the main part of the case really happened in the late 40s, late 40s, early 50s. And back in that time period, there were a lot of what they called these lonely hearts. Clubs were is essentially one of the clubs would compile a list of the different members in the club, and these would be women, lots of women, and also men who paid a certain fee, whatever it happened to be. You know, wasn't anything extravagant, but they would pay the fee to join the club, and then they would get their name listed in the club, and they would get their basic information listed. It was you know, kind of comparable to like an online dating service today. Except, of course, back then, you know, there's no internet, there's no online anything. So what they did is they had these clubs, and people would write into the clubs after seeing advertisements in different periodicals, different, you know, newspapers or magazines, these sorts of things. People would then write into the clubs to join them, and then once they joined, they would receive a list of all the members of the club, and then they would have information about them, and then they could, at that point, reach out to the members and contact them and, you know, see if there's, you know, mutual interest in pursuing some sort of romantic relationship or the like. So that is how these two folks ended up meeting to begin with. A friend of Martha Beck's actually signed her up for one of these Lonely Heart Clubs without her knowing it. And as a result of that, Raymond Fernandez came across her name and her information. And then he wrote to her, contacted her, kind of told her a little bit about himself. And, you know, they started exchanging letters back and forth over a period of time. And then eventually they ended up meeting. And so that's how they ended up getting together.
Right. What do we know about Martha Beck? Now, she was, born in, I think, 1920 in Florida. So, Martha Beck, so what can you tell us about her?
She would have been about 27 or so when she met Raymond Fernandez. But she was born in the Panhandle. She had some older sisters. She had, I guess you would describe it as, you know, not your typical childhood. She had some rough things in her background. You know, she was a good student. She did well in school. She was kind of quiet, pretty well-mannered from all accounts and these sorts of things. But she had a condition that caused her to physically mature very much earlier than, you know, girls typically did. So, you know, she developed breasts and kind of started getting a figure and these sorts of things that attracted, you know, boys' attention and the attention of men as well. At an earlier age than, you know, a girl would typically have to deal with that sort of thing. So she had that happen. She also had some incidents with family members as she was growing up. You know, she had the family life wasn't a peaceful leave it to beaver kind of bliss kind of thing at all. There was a lot of fighting between her mother and father. They didn't get along very well.
Didn't she claim that her brother raped her?
Yes. So when she was a little bit older, when she was about 13, she claimed that her brother, Dudley, who was 17 at the time, raped her in their house, in their own home there.
Oh, okay.
He did it then, and he did it like a week or so later, as well. So that was certainly something that had an impact on her, as you might imagine, you know, psychologically. She really, her self-esteem really took a hit on that. And, you know, her mother really didn't, do much as far as comforting her or, you know, really being there for her, or kind of quite the opposite, actually. Her mother kind of blamed her for what happened, basically. And became, you know, even more restrictive with what Martha was able to do than what she'd done before. And she already, you know, was pretty restrictive, but this made it even worse. And a lot of blame, like I said, from the mother for what happened. She didn't really blame the brother. She blamed Martha for what happened. And, you know, as a consequence of that, you know, forced her to take some kind of weird concoction to make sure she didn't get pregnant and all these sorts of things. So her mother was very controlling, not supportive at all. And, this, you know, this is something that impacted her psychologically as well growing up. In, you know, in addition to the rape, she also claimed that, I believe it was an uncle, had molested her even at a younger age than that, you know, when she was, I don't know, maybe like 9 or 10, something like that. She claimed that an uncle had basically come on to her and molested her or tried to molest her back when she was younger, too. So she certainly had these kind of incidents growing up as well.
Question, JT. Do you think when she was claiming these, she was trying to maybe justify to the court?
Well, it's certainly possible. And, you know, that's, now that you mentioned that, that's one of the other interesting things about this story is there's so many different versions of the murders that happened in the case that I don't think anybody ever really knew for sure what really happened. You know, see, well, which one seems to make the most sense given what we do know, and you know, kind of go from there.
Right.
So getting back to your question, yeah, I mean, she could have made some of this stuff up, but from the best I could tell from, you know, the way that family members reacted to these things, it certainly seems like the rape with the brother actually occurred. I never really came across anything that seems to cast a whole lot of doubt on that from happening.
Right.
Were these Lonely Heart Clubs really popular back then? Were a lot of people belonged to them?
Yeah, I mean, they're back at that time. They were huge. They were big deals. I mean, there were a lot of them. They were located all over the country, and they had, you know, each of them had hundreds of members. So they were definitely they were big time back then. You know, again, I guess again the. The most comparable thing I could think of today would be, you know, online dating. These matchmaker things online, you know, there's, you know, who knows how many people are members of those, but it's a lot. And, you know, so kind of think of it in those terms back then.
I guess, but I would think that they wouldn't, you know, times were different in the 40s. I'm sure that, well, maybe I'm wrong, but did they meet, and it wasn't like a hookup sort of thing. Like a lot of the online apps now, people are much freer and will hook up much quicker. So back then it was more serious, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, these weren't typically just kind of one-night stand hookup sort of things. Like you say, this was more typically the folks involved, you know, at least the ones that were legit, they were looking for more serious relationships. And it seems like quite a lot of them tended to be older women. Oftentimes they were, you know, widows. Their husbands had, you know, maybe died in the war or after, or whatever, and they're looking for, you know, potentially a new husband.
So what can you tell us about Raymond Fernandez?
So Raymond Fernandez had an interesting backstory. He was born in Hawaii. His father was Spanish. He was from Spain and had moved over to Hawaii for work. Shortly after Ray was born, the family moved to Connecticut. And he lived there for most of his adolescence. He lived there in Connecticut. His father, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of a flip, I guess, of Martha's family. And Martha's family, the mother was the one that kind of wore the pants in the family. And in Ray's house, it was the other way around. The father definitely ran the house. He was, by accounts, a very harsh disciplinarian. At high expectations, demands. So that was kind of Ray's home life. And he grew up in this house, didn't really get to experience a lot of things that his when he graduated elementary school, grammar school, as you would call it, instead of moving on with the rest of his classmates, you know, going on to high school and whatnot, his father took him out of school, made him work on the family farm, these kind of things. And, you know, there's a story that I recount in the book about when Ray was a kid. He was, I don't know, he was about, I guess, maybe 15 or something. He wanted to have like a real Thanksgiving, like experience like a real American kind of Thanksgiving. And his father wouldn't have anything to do with it. He absolutely refused. And he told him, you know, if you want any kind of thing like that, you're going to have to make it happen, basically. So as a consequence of that, Ray got a couple of his friends together, and they went out and they stole some chickens from a nearby chicken farm, you know, so they could have, you know, kind of a comparable to, I guess, a turkey, I guess. But so he went out and did that, got caught, of course. His two friends, you know, the parents of the two friends came and got them, but Ray's dad refused to come get him. And so, you know, Ray went into custody there and at the juvenile facility. And ended up, you know, being convicted
for how long?
Of stealing these chickens, and had to serve, you know, jail time. His father had him sit in the jail for 60 days, I think the sentence was for. So it's kind of a good example of the father-son relationship there, how kind of strict and harsh this kind of relationship was. So anyway, as Ray got older, he moved to Spain, back to Spain with his mom. The father stayed behind in Connecticut for work. And eventually the Spanish Civil War broke out in Spain, and Ray got caught up in that. He got married over there in Spain to a Spanish girl. He had a child over there, a son, and then got caught up in the Spanish Civil War, as I said, which was not a pleasant experience for him. He was basically forced to fight for one of the sides there for Franco's forces, and experienced a lot of bad things, saw a lot of bad things happen to his friends and people he knew. And I'm sure that affected him to some extent. When he was eventually, after the war ended, he had an interesting job working for the British as a spy during World War II. Did some things for them. And then after World War II ended, he was going back to the U.S. In a ship, and there was a really bad storm at sea, you know, huge waves and everything pounding the ship. And the ship started, you know, taking on some water and things. So he was trying to help out with that, and a big wave basically struck the ship while he was doing that. And he was, you know, down trying to help man the water pumps, and the impact of the wave on the ship knocked a big heavy metal door, like a hatch door, down on top of Ray's head. So this is like the 6 feet high door. It was, you know, this thick steel, and it came down and slammed him on the head, and you know, knocked him loopy, and he ended up having like a, you know, like a huge scar, because it's like a 3-inch long scar on his forehead, on his head there. Was hospitalized for weeks and weeks and weeks. And this is apparently something that, you know, really altered his personality as well. His family members and people who knew him said that he changed quite a bit after that accident happened.
So that's the frontal lobes that he got hit in, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there was, you know, of course, there was some psychiatric evaluation later on that references that as, you know, pointing to something that, you know, really could have been an ultimate cause of things he did later on. So that's kind of his background. I mean, one other kind of interesting thing, I guess, about his background is when he was, you know, he worked on these different ships, and on one occasion he was on a ship that came back to the U.S., and when it came back in dock, instead of, you know, getting off the ship, he signed up to stay on to help out as like a steward on the ship to help kind of clean up and get everything, you know, back up to what it needed to be after when it had been on there for so long. Anyway, so he signed up for that. And then when he got done with that, he noticed, you know, the other stewards were like packing up their stuff, and they were taking towels and linens and, you know, stuff like that, and putting it in with their stuff, you know, just stealing it basically. So he saw them doing that, and he thought, oh yeah, I may as well do that too. So he tried to take some of that stuff as well, and he got caught. You know, and it wasn't a ton of stuff, but he definitely got caught stealing things and was arrested, and was encouraged to plead guilty to get a lenient sentence. And he did plead guilty, but he ended up getting a sentence of a year in federal prison. And he served that time in the Panhandle in Tallahassee, Florida, which kind of coincidentally isn't too far from Pensacola and Milton, which is where Martha Beck was from. But anyway, while he was there in the prison in Tallahassee, he befriended one of the other prisoners there who was a Haitian who actually practiced voodoo. And so Ray got really interested in this voodoo, started reading up on it, became convinced that he could, you know, he could hypnotize people and have this kind of supernatural influence on others, including women. And that's kind of something that stuck with him going forward as well. So kind of another little interesting aspect of his background.
That was after this accident that hit his head, isn't it? And you said that member said that his personality changed a bit after that.
Yeah, they said he became much more aggressive, had much more of a quick temper than before, and he himself, you know, reported that he had headaches, severe headaches, off and on, throughout his life after that.
What I like about this, JT, is the frontal lobes is where you've got the anterior insula, which is a major component for remorse or lack of remorse if it's damaged. And so that pathway between the amygdala where you get the anger and the fear and that right there, I'm curious to see if, I mean, to kill somebody, I could see if, you know, that pathway is messed up. Some of his life before it sounds like there were some ups and downs, but I think everybody has ups and downs. I'm really intrigued by this accident that he had.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like you said, it seems to be a key aspect of what led him to do the things he did later on. It's certainly something that you could, you know, hone in on and say this very likely had great influence on what happened later on.
And do you think that he joined these groups to manipulate women? Was he that type of person?
Well, I mean, after this accident happened to him, he certainly changed and kind of became this darker kind of personality. You know, the way he kind of got into that, he was, after he got released from the federal prison, he went and lived with his sister in New York. And while he was living with her, you know, he was sitting around at her house one day, kind of just bored and thumbing through some magazines she had. And she had some sort of magazine there, some sort of like housekeeping magazine or something. And he thumbed through that and he came across an advertisement for one of these clubs, one of these Lonely Hearts clubs, and decided that he was going to join up to it. So, you know, whether he did that originally, on the up and up, like he was really just trying to look for some sort of romantic relationship, or whether he, from the very beginning, decided that he was going to use this as a way to potentially cash in on this and take advantage of these older women and things. You know, you can't say 100%, but it looks like he had kind of a plan from the get-go, from, you know, just kind of the way the events unfolded.
How did the two of them get together and start doing crime, murder?
So, yeah, it's interesting because before Martha got together with Ray, I mean, she had no kind of, you know, issues with breaking the law or anything like that in her background. So there was nothing that you could look to and say, oh, you know, she's going to turn out doing bad things later on. There was really nothing like that, in, you know, before she met Ray. So the way that they met was, you know, of course, through one of these Lonely Hearts clubs. One of Martha's friends at the time signed her up for the club, you know, without letting Martha know that. And what happened was Ray ended up coming across Martha's information on that club because he was a member of that particular club. And he wrote to Martha, introducing himself and, you know, saying he was interested in corresponding with her and that sort of thing. And so they ended up corresponding over, you know, weeks and months back and forth. And, you know, as they did, they got, you know, opened up more and more came closer and that sort of thing. And the relationship grew, this kind of correspondence relationship. And eventually they met in person. After Ray came back to the United States, he had, after he had first introduced himself to Martha through the letters, he had made a trip back to Spain with another woman, by the way, who he had met through another club. And the woman that went with him to Spain ended up dying over there of very questionable means.
Oh, interesting.
And, yeah, and you know, at the time there weren't any charges or anything like that for Ray, but eventually the Spanish authorities ended up issuing a warrant for him because they wanted to talk to him about what happened. But by then he was long gone. He was out of Spain again, back in the U.S. So anyway, he had made this trip to Spain, and then he had come back to the U.S. And shortly after getting back to the U.S., he sent a telegram to Martha and said, you know, I can't wait anymore. I have to meet you and all this sort of stuff. And so they ended up meeting. Ray took a train to Florida, to Pensacola. And it was in December of 1947, shortly before Christmas, around Christmas time. He came down to Pensacola and Martha met him there at the train station. And, she was right away struck by him. You know, kind of as an aside, Martha was like a big movie fan, particularly of this actor, Charles Boyer. He was in some of these famous movies back in like the 30s and stuff, including this film Gaslight, which he starred in with Ingrid Bergman. So he was this kind of this movie star at the time that she was really intrigued by and attracted to. So anyway, Ray Fernandez, he looked an awful lot like this guy, this movie star. So when he got off the train, you know, Martha was like instantly attracted to him. You know, it was like this movie star had just like stepped off the train, you know. So there was this instant attraction by her. On the flip side, you know, when Ray first saw Martha, you know, it wasn't quite what he was expecting because I don't think I mentioned him before, but Martha was kind of a heavier set woman. She didn't have, you know, real thin, you know, frame or anything. She had kind of this bigger frame and she's kind of heavy set and things. And so, it wasn't quite what Ray was expecting, but, anyway, you know, they hit it off pretty well. He stayed with her for several days. You know, she took him back to her place, made him dinner and all that kind of thing. And, see, he would have been about 33 years old at the time. She would have been about 27. And then eventually he, you know, after a few days, he said, well, I got to go back to New York. I have to leave. Kind of made up a reason for having to go. And, you know, she was real disappointed with it. But he went back and then he later wrote her and said that, you know, he didn't think that they should really pursue a relationship. You know, he didn't want to like lead her on, that sort of thing. And she wasn't very happy to get back.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
As you might expect. So she ended up going back up to New York, unannounced, kind of surprising him.
Followed him to New York.
Yeah, she went back up there eventually. They ended up staying together again for a while. And they had a pretty good time for a while. She actually was like one of her happiest times of her life. She said later on. And then while they were together, eventually Ray let her know what he was doing, using these things to kind of meet up with these women and take advantage of them and, basically fleecing these women that he met through the club for whatever he did, whatever kind of money he could get. He let Martha know that eventually. And by that time, she was so caught up with him romantically. She was so in love with him that it didn't really, it bothered her, but it didn't send her running or anything like that. She wasn't going to leave him by that time. She was just too wrapped up with him. So she kind of became his, accomplice in these things. She started posing as his sister when he would go meet other women, and help him out with these things. So the two of them kind of had this racket going together where they would, pretend that they would find women in these clubs, and the clubs, as part of the description, the women would include what kind of, what their finances were, basically. So Ray would, of course, target ones that had disclosed, a good amount of money, and those would be the ones he would try to meet. So that's what they did. They went around meeting women all over the place, all kinds of different states, multiple states. It's all talked about in the book, but they would do this together. And sometimes the women would kind of start figuring out what's going on, leave. Sometimes they would end up mysteriously dying. These sorts of things. And then, ultimately the way Martha and Ray got caught is, they ended up getting together with a woman and, who had a young child. And after they ended up killing them, the neighbors became very suspicious and alerted the police to them, and the police came and, they ended up eventually discovering the bodies, and then one thing led to another, and then they figured out that Ray and Martha had probably killed these other people and all this sort of thing. So
that was Grand Rapids, Michigan, right?
Yes, they were in, it was in Michigan when they were with the woman who had the younger child, and that's when they ended up being apprehended up in Michigan.
So, JT, I got to let you know. I was in Pensacola, Florida during flight training. I'm in New York now, and I'm from Grand Rapids, Michigan. So, So Al was thinking that I'm related to one of these, right, Al? but I have a question, though. Or were you going to say something, Al?
No, I was going to say that it's just your parents.
That's right. That's right. So, but the question I had read about that, did she kill first, according, let's say, that Raymond had a sexual relationship or something, and so she got upset and she murdered this woman? And that was in New York?
Yeah, so before they were arrested and taken into custody in Michigan, yeah, they had been in New York, and Ray had been involved with another woman there that he met through one of the other clubs. Her name was Janet Fay, there in New York, and they had got a bunch of money out of Janet Fay. Basically, when you kind of calculate it, you know, for what it would be worth today, I think they basically got about over $60,000 from her. In the form of, like, basically, like, cashier's checks and some cash and things like that. So when they were with Janet in New York one night, and again, this is where it really comes in, where there's all these different versions of exactly what happened, but that particular night, which is the night of January 3rd, 1949, Janet was killed. The three of them were staying at Ray and Martha's apartment, and during the overnight hours, you know, early morning hours, they ended up murdering Janet. And who actually killed her and how is one of these murky kind of things. There's different stories. There's one version that you mentioned, where Martha was jealous about the sexual relationship that may have been going on between Janet and Ray. And so because of that, she murdered Janet. But then, you know, there's other versions where Ray had told Martha earlier that night that he had gone down to the car and retrieved a hammer and brought it back up and told Martha that, you know, they're probably going to need it later on, you know, indicating that they're going to have to use it on Janet to get rid of her. And, you know, there's a version where Ray essentially tells Martha that if he really loves her, I mean, if she really loves him, sorry, if Martha really loves Ray, then she'll kill Janet by using the hammer and hitting her in the head with it. And so that's one of the versions of it, that that she knocks Janet in the head with the hammer a couple times to kill her. And then after being struck by the hammer, Ray ends up taking a handkerchief and making a noose out of it, for lack of a better word, and strangling her with it to kind of finish her off. And, you know, there was testimony at trial from the doctors that, you know, did the autopsy on Janet's body about what really caused her death. And the testimony was that either one of these two events could have killed her. You know, the hitting in the head with a hammer could have killed her eventually, but also the strangulation could have killed her as well. So, you know, that was another issue that kind of went into a trial. But these different versions of this event about, you know, who really kind of struck the first blow, so to speak, against Janet Fay, and what exactly happened. So it changed. I think I counted up, there was four or five different versions of it ultimately.
Well, I'm going to make another version here. Not really, but here it is. Janet is a nurse, and her job is, you know, taking care of people. No history of violence. And here's a guy that has a history of messing with the frontal lobes and also having issues. And then even a rumor in Spain that there may have been a, he may have murdered somebody. You know, that's, you know, questionable. But still, sounds to me like Raymond's the one that's pushing the buttons here.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly seemed to be the kind of the dominant partner of the two, you know, the one that kind of ultimately controlled everything, because, you know, it seems like Janet became so wrapped up with him, so intrigued with him, so in love with him, that she would basically do whatever he wanted her to. And, you know, she testified to that at trial at different times as well, saying, you know, if Ray told me to stop breathing, I would do it. You know, that's how much I loved him. So, you know, you have to take that with a little bit of a grain of salt and think, well, you know, she's trying to save herself too. So she's saying this to, you know, kind of as an excuse for what she did, trying to, you know, to lessen her own responsibility, her own culpability for the crimes. Or is it, you know, 100% accurate? You know, certainly it looks like she was definitely very much attached to him and definitely very much influenced by him and would certainly want to make him happy and, you know, appease him and all that sort of thing. So,
so question like said, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, when they killed, what is that, Delphine Downing? Did they get caught? How did they get caught?
So, well, after they killed her, her young daughter was still alive. She was about 2 or 3 years old, and they were trying to figure out what to do with the daughter. And they ultimately decided they couldn't really keep her around. It would be too hard to try to explain, you know, why they had her and all that sort of thing. So what happened was Ray told Martha they needed to get rid of her. So he kind of assigned that task to her and said, you know, I don't really care how you do it, but you need to get rid of her. So Martha, apparently Martha took the little girl down in the basement and ended up drowning her in you know, kind of make it even more disturbing. He drowned, the water he used to drown her in was actually water that had been filling up the hole that Ray had dug to bury the mother in when they were, you know, digging the hole to hide her body in. This is water that he had bailed out of it. So she ended up, this water was in this tub, and she ended up drowning the little girl in it. So having killed both of them and hiding the bodies in the basement there, you know, they put them in the hole and put her back on it and then, you know, covered it with fresh cement, you know, to make it look like it was, you know, nothing other than the basement floor or whatnot. But after they had done this, they would like went out to the movies, went into town and went to the movies that night. And then when they got back home from the movies, shortly after they got there was a knock at the door, and it was the police, you know, the local police there in Michigan. And what had happened is the neighbors, Delphine's neighbors, had been very suspicious. They'd been kind of suspicious from the beginning when they first heard about Delphine getting together with Raymond and kind of what was going on and how fast the relationship was developing and things. And they'd been concerned and things. And then when she went missing, of course, they became even more concerned. So they called the police and asked the police just to go out and, you know, basically do a welfare check on Delphine there. And so the police showed up, they knock on the door, and, you know, Ray answers it, and they ask him, well, you know, where's Delphine? And, you know, he tells them, oh, she had to go visit her relatives. It was like an emergency. She had to go. And, you know, well, where's the little girl? Oh, she took her with her as well. And we're just here basically house sitting, you know, we're just watching the house for them while they're gone. And they're like, okay, well, can we come in and, you know, check the house? And he's like, sure. And so, you know, they come inside, and eventually they you know, they go down in the basement and they see this fresh cement there. And of course, you know, that kind of gets their attention, and, you know, they eventually end up finding the bodies there, and including the little girl who apparently her body was still warm, you know, because it hadn't been that long since she'd been killed. Wow. So they found the body and, of course, arrested them. And that's how they were taken into custody. And then, you know, they eventually ended up confessing to murdering Janet Fay in New York as well. And that's actually the case that they went to trial on, was the Janet Fay murder in New York. So they were arrested in Michigan for the Downing murders. But Michigan at the time did not have the death penalty. They might still not. I'm not exactly sure on that, but certainly at the time they did not have it, and New York did. So there was kind of an agreement that was reached between the, you know, the two states and the two governors, and they were extradited to New York for trial there. And so that's where they went to trial for the Janet Faye murder there.
And then one question is, I noticed, wasn't there 17 murders they may have been attributed to, or is that just hypothetical, or is this?
Yeah, I mean, putting an exact figure on it is pretty difficult. I know they were suspected in quite a few, you know, around the country. You know, the ones we can say for sure the two in Michigan. We can definitely say the Janet Faye in New York. We can definitely point and raise a big red flag to the woman in Spain with Ray. Of course, that was before he met Martha. There was another woman. There was a woman from Arkansas who they fleeced together, drugged and put her on her bus, you know, sending her back where she came from. And she was found on the bus and in a really bad state, ended up dying, you know, not long after that, within a few days, I think it was. There's certainly a big red flag with that one. Those for sure. And the other, you know, some other possibilities around, but, you know, they didn't tie them definitively to any of the other ones.
So the, like when you look at all the various serial offender motives, and I've noticed in a lot of your books that you do have sadosexual serial killers that you've done. This couple seems to me that their agenda wasn't to kill; it was to get the money, and then one of the MO is to kill so they don't get caught or something to the effect. Or would you think that there was an interest in kill as well?
Yeah, I think this one. Yeah, exactly like you said. I think this one, it wasn't so much the thrill of the kill. It was more just as kind of a means to an end, you know, as to help them get
right,
the money
right.
And then they needed to get rid of the witnesses and things. So, yeah, it was more to kind of help facilitate what they were more wanting to do, which was, you know, get the money from these women, exploit them, take them for whatever they could. And, you know, if need be, as part of that, if they had to kill them, then, you know, so be it.
That still shows extreme lack of remorse right there, so.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I mean, killing a 2 or 3 year old little girl, I mean, that's, you know, it takes a certain kind of person to do that. So, you know, we talked about Ray and the fact that he had this frontal lobe injury. So, you know, for him to do it, that's, you know, maybe that's one thing you could kind of explain that away. But if Martha really did drown her, then, you know, how do you explain that? I mean, that's a pretty powerful influence that Ray would have over her.
That's true. Yeah.
To do something like that. So.
You know, so let's say, for example, Ray, like many serial offenders, they have almost an inability to feel remorse. But Martha, she must have been repressing like crazy. If she just had a normal ability to remorse and then had, you know, this is really, you know, that Raymond really messed with her emotionally, you're just like you said, that's a different kind of, I mean, it's more of a normal kind of response. I mean, in a weird way than not having remorse.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember, I mean, I think there was, you know, after she was in custody when the psychiatrist for the state examined her, I think one of the things that they found was that her emotional development had stopped at a pretty young age. I think she was like 8 or 9 years old, basically. They thought her emotional growth had stopped. So that might be part of the explanation. Yeah. You know, based on the things that had happened to her.
Right.
What happened in the trial then? How did the trial go?
So the trial, I found the trial really interesting too, because what happened to the trial, both Ray and Martha, You know, they're both on trial for murder. And they both had the same attorney, which is very interesting because there's no way something like that would happen now. I mean, there's too much of a potential of conflict of interest in this sort of thing. There's just no way that you would have two people on trial for murder with the same lawyer representing them. So this same attorney represented the both of them at trial, despite the fact that they're both trying to avoid a guilty verdict on Janet Faye's murder. Ray's defense basically being, they both started out with insanity pleas as their defenses. But then as the trial went on later on in the trial, actually, the attorney ended up withdrawing the insanity plea for Ray. Kept it there for Martha, but withdrew it for Ray. So they're both at trial, and they both testified at trial, which is also interesting because that doesn't always happen in murder trials as well. You know, the accused doesn't always testify because there's just so much bad that can come out of that for the defense. But in this case, they both testified at the trial, and you know, they had different versions of events, sometimes contradicting their own prior statements about what happened. You know, of the killing, and then also sometimes contradicting each other versions of what happened. So there's definitely this conflict of interest going on at the trial. You know, Ray denied killing Janet Faye outright. He just outright denied doing it. He denied planning on killing her. You know, this part about, well, he went down and got the hammer and brought it up and told Martha we may need to use this later and this sort of thing. He completely denied that ever happening.
Of course, he did.
yeah. I mean, he basically said there was no reason for him to kill her because he'd already duped her out of all the money, so there was no reason at that point to kill her. And then Martha, her approach was that she didn't remember what happened, basically, that she had experienced this kind of blackout. And, you know, when she came back to her senses, there was Janet, you know, collapsed on the floor there with blood coming out of her head. And Martha couldn't remember what had happened. She had blacked out, kind of had this amnesic sort of event. So she was trying to avoid responsibility that way by saying, you know, she didn't have the intent to kill her and wasn't in a right state of mind and all that sort of thing. And so, of course, there was a lot of expert testimony back and forth from different psychiatrists for the prosecution and the defense about whether or not Martha could have, you know, had the required mental state to be held criminally responsible for murder or not. That went back and forth during the trial. You know, it was kind of interesting that later on after the trial, I mean, well, I guess let me step back. So they're both convicted. Okay. They're both convicted of first degree murder. You know, they could have been convicted of lesser crimes, but they're both convicted of first degree murder. Both sentenced to death. They both go to Sing Sing prison, which is, you know, another kind of interesting part for me is just because, you know, Sing Sing prison is this, you know, very, very famous, well-known penal institution, right? And, you know, where the death penalty by electric chair really, you know, originated. You know, they had old Sparky there and a lot of famous executions there in the electric chair. So they both went there. That's where, you know, they both served time there before their death sentences were ultimately carried out. And then, you know, kind of after this, after their executions and some time passed, one of the medical experts for the defense one of their psychiatrists there. He claimed that that Martha had given him kind of like the ultimate version of what really happened. She had given him like the true statement of events. And this was something that was put out, as I said, after they were both had been killed. I think that was like the fifth version basically of what had happened. So, and he also claimed that he took what she wrote and showed Ray it, and Ray had confirmed that was the truth. But that, he wasn't going to admit that to anybody, other than his own defense, medical expert, basically. So all these different versions of it. So, which one's really the truth, probably will never really know, but, all you know for sure is that, these women died, in particular Janet Faye, she died this brutal death, and, both Ray and Martha were there at the time it happened, and they both, benefited from it, and both tried to get away with it. I do. It's jthunter.org. It's not .com, it's .org. I couldn't get the .com at the time, so I just went with the .org. So it's jthunter.org. I'm on all my stuff's on Amazon, including this. So if you just go on Amazon and type in the book title, Tortured with Love, or just put in JT Hunter, either one, that'll get you there. I'm also on Twitter, JTH True Crime. I'm on there quite a bit. And also Instagram, JT Hunter TC for True Crime. So you can find me all those places.
Perfect. Now, we'll have your book up as well, and we'll put your website in, and so that it'll be linked with ours, and people listening, so it's easy to find, just one click. Again, thank you very much for taking the time to talk about your new book.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys. Thanks a lot for having me on. Hope to be on again in the not-too-distant future.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
How dare you!
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah.
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.